after class, don't say anything right now, okay? So what I wanted to do is for you to problematize the Te Maori exhibition for me, so I can make sure, as they say in the business world, we're all on the same page. Don't you hate that? But anyway, so I just want to make sure, since it's the beginning of the class, that you understand sort of my theoretical punch when I'm teaching. So who wants to start the discussion on Te Maori? Yes, sir.
So what are the problems after the
Loud MoMA? Enough for them.
One of the problems after the MoMA show was that the MoMA kind of appropriated things from foreign cultures and just showed them without any kind of correlation or, you know, just kind of showed similarities.
Right. No. The similarities were only formal.
Formal, yes.
Remember that color. Word. Okay.
Yeah, not culturally.
Right,
not
exactly.
Appropriated visual aesthetics.
Right.
The Te Maori, what they tried to do is bring up the indigenous people and incorporate them into the show. But what ended up happening, because of maybe superficial press, is that the warriors, you know, doing their postures like sticking out the tongue, insulting the people, were then used for novelty.
Very
and
good.
It was kind of spectator.
Right. It's sort of the spectacle syndrome, right? We could call it the spectacle syndrome, in fact. And there's actually a pair. Is everybody understanding this? So one of the things we have to ask ourselves is, if we want to do multicultural exhibitions, because that's what this part of the course is in the beginning, about multiculturalism, if we want to do multicultural exhibitions, how can we avoid the pitfalls of both primitivism and Te Maori? So in primitivism, we had this idea of appropriation, of a one-way appropriation, not a dialogue, right? And in Te Maori, we had this idea of the spectacle. But the spectacle is really about the other. The other invariably becomes the spectacle. So the point that I'm trying to raise in your minds is these are two syndromes of contemporary museum exhibitions. It's two pitfalls where in art history, museum exhibitions really is what brings the art to the scholars and the public's attention. So we're in this trip of having to use the museum exhibition as our platform. But the point here is, how does one avoid the conundrum, if you will, of either appropriation or spectacle? Yeah.
Well, isn't that tied to the curator of a museum? They can't control who their audience is, and if their audience is already viewing as the other and it's completely separate from the art world, there's really no way to control that spectacle, you know, from happening. You know, the curator could have the best intentions in the world, but if their viewer is going to do that regardless, then you know.
So you're going to say that no matter what the museum, we'll call it the museum, no matter what the museum does, there is always going to be that possibility of a spectacle for consumption. That's basically what I'm hearing you saying?
Yeah, but more specifically, it's like the society is like that, so...
Right. Anybody want to respond, sir?
According to the board, the idea of the museum is to show things in ways of... in the basic of the museum, to show things to the others. So the people that go to see them in the Maori already doing something, it's not according to the natural things. They are not going in the proper world where this the operas come from. They're going in a place, and the objects are there, not the people in the original place. The opposite. So I think that it's something pertaining to this exposition. And could be something natural, is really a difficult thing to obtain. From the other aspect of the primitivism, I was wondering, yes, is important asking about why the, sorry for English,
That's okay. Keep going. You're trying. That's what counts.
It's important to ask why the MoMA didn't pay the respect to the culture of the operas. But
the operas meaning the work, everybody.
Yeah,
he's putting his Spanish in there, but I get it. I can speak Spanish.
Italian.
So he means
Italian.
What?
Italian.
What?
Italian.
Italian, same word then. Right?
Yeah.
So basically what this gentleman is saying is that MoMA did not do anything to make the work be
exactly
read on any other level.
But I was wondering, even Picasso, Matisse, and the other didn't do it, so I was wondering, why should the MoMA in an exposition dedicated to them do something that they even didn't do it?
1906, 1984.
Of course.
No, it's not of course. In other words, you learn by history, right? So, yes, Picasso and Matisse, etc., for their time period, were in a certain kind of mental capacity, an intellectual capacity about this great discovery of other cultures. But instead of taking that discovery and feeding it into a 1980s lens, which MoMA could have done by the 1980s, they decided to, in their mind, replicate that 1906 mentality. You can't replicate a 1906 mentality in a museum exhibition in 1980. Otherwise, think politically. What happens, we're gonna learn about an exhibition that Hitler put up in Germany, right? We can't replicate that exhibition in the year 2005. Think of what would happen. So my answer to you is, the difference is in the time period.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think I kind of view it in the same way as him at first. I was trying to figure it out why. Because I do think to a certain extent, because it was so topical, you know, their original influence. But in respect to the other, the Tim Mowry shows, well, I think that the dialogue was only opened up both one way in both situations. Like in one situation, there was only the 1906 dialogue, and in the other situation, there was only the 1985 dialogue. There was only this kind of, well, we'll let them do everything, but because their culture has already become this sort of tourist attraction, of course they're gonna play it up. So there was almost an input of 1985 US that needed to be put out to them, as well as the 1981 African culture that
right
needed to be put on.
Okay.
The
okay. Here's my, if I were curating that exhibition, I would have had the ceremonies be held privately. But guess what? We wouldn't have gotten the press, and we wouldn't have gotten in Time Magazine, and we wouldn't have gotten Charlie, whatever his name is, on NBC to come around. So this is the conundrum in the museum world. Yes, it is important that the Maoris chose the objects, and they decided they had to bless them, and they were ancestral objects, etc. Why not let them do it privately and open the show? And then the answer would have been, of course, press.
How did the Maori view the exhibition at the expo during, like, afterwards? How did they view?
I wish I could tell you that, but I was in New Zealand in 1985, and then I got back in time for the opening in San Francisco. And I talked to, I think I explained this to you, that the Maoris have a Department of Maori Studies that would be our ethnic, like our ethnic studies, and it's a very important department in the University at Wellington. And they were the people who told me to watch the press. But I didn't get to interview any of them afterwards. So I wish I could tell you if there was Maori reaction, or perhaps, as it's been brought out, they're so used to their culture being spectacleized that it didn't make any difference. But I don't know. But it's a good question. And, you know, in my course, my point is you ask questions that you... It's more important to ask the right question than it is to sometimes get the right answer. Over here.
I have a question about the comment you made last week about the exhibition at MoMA, which is, you said it was one way.
Yes.
Maybe the West was kind of getting the...
Right, the West just took what they wanted.
Is that on purpose, or really the other cultures really want to display, like, Western cultures? Like,
no, no, but think about this.
Because, you know,
the show went up in 1984. The other cultures were not contacted. That's the whole point about the primitivism show. That section that I ended up with, by the way, your e-reserve is going to go up maybe tomorrow. There's your word. You know, your source word, your secret password. Okay? Whatever it is, and it makes sense if you read the last lecture, you know that it's going to be imperialism. I want to tell you that when you email me and say, Professor, I forgot the password, I will not email you back with a password. You have to come and see me personally to get it. So, is this about this? Yeah, what?
Is it case sensitive, all
capital? It's case sensitive and it's all uppercase. So, to get back to this point, even in the contemporary explorations section of the MoMA exhibition, so that's the last section I talked about in my lecture, there was no consultation involved. So those, the comparative objects, as it were done only curatorially with no consultation.
Oh, if it was, would the other cultures want it?
There's no if. I can't answer an if because it wasn't. Yes?
How are they supposed to, if many of these artifacts that they were showing, most of them seem to me come from Africa or...
Oceania, right.
Yeah. These, you know, groups are constantly changing and constantly, how are they supposed to get, you know, even one group to come and say, you represent this, you know, this came from you guys, you know, when in Africa changes so quickly.
I think some of that will be answered by the first exhibition we're doing now, which is Mizushin de la Terre.
Okay.
So hang on to that thought, because I think part of the answer might come up. So is everybody comfortable with what we've done so far then?
Mm-hmm.
Sort of, yeah.
I have a question that's more about like how we're going to be tested. I've never taken an art history class, so I just kind of want to know like what should I be paying attention to, what's going to be on the test. What kind of material? Are we supposed to know like all the names of all the different artifacts?
Okay, let's call them art objects first of all.
Art objects.
Thank you. An artifact has a connotation of deadness. You will go to your e-reserves. The slide images that you will be tested on will come from the e-reserves. Okay? The intellectual matter you will be tested on will come from my lectures. Does that help?
The slides, are we going to have to know like the names and the dates and everything?
Yeah, straight art history. But I'm not going to give you a regurgitation question. There won't be 50 slides of 30 seconds each. There'll be like 5 slides of 15 minutes each, or comparisons of 20 minutes, or something like, maybe 20 minutes is too long, but it'll be something that you have to give me a paragraph of an answer, not a 2-word answer.
About a slide?
About an image or a comparative image. Yeah. Yeah.
In the late 90s, the Spice Girls, the band that was on...
Yeah, I know who they are.
went to New Zealand, and they actually performed in front of a group of Maori people, and they were doing like a Maori warrior dance.
Maori. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's okay.
And there was like a negative reaction to
I'm sure.
The dance. So it's almost like even this exhibition, that's even seemed like they realized that they were, it seems to me that they realized that they were put on.
I don't know because I didn't interview anybody and I haven't read an article. I mean, in the Maori press in New Zealand, perhaps there were articles. I just don't know. The Spice Girls did a Maori dance? Just wait till you see what I'm going to show you today from Sports Illustrated. I know, we live in a Spice Girls. I just can't get over this. Does anybody have a video of that? I would love to see it. How do you know about that?
YouTube.
Somebody get me that. Somebody, I don't know, from YouTube. I mean, I don't know. All this technical stuff kind of makes me crazy. I want to see what they did. Okay? So somebody, be nice to me and show it to me. Wow. That's a new one. Okay, so we are going to start with Musicien de la Terre.
It's going.
Yeah, here it is. Okay. So I'm just not used to that. This was an exhibition that, it's a little controversial as to when exactly this exhibition started being planned, but it certainly had enough time between 1984 and 1989 to be dubbed as a reaction to primitivism. And this brings up a very age-old question about, not question, but sort of dialogue, which is a post-World War II dialogue about the United States usurping the role of the avant-garde in mainstream art away from France. So if you've taken other art history courses, you might know, you know, you might understand that you learn about Paris, and here comes World War II, and then you learn about New York. So there's always been this tension. When so we have to look at Musicien as a statement on the part of the French government, because it was in a national museum and was funded nationally. You know, most countries of the world have a minister of culture. We don't. So, no, it's something to think about. Most countries of the world have a position, a ministry of culture. Not even close in this country. Another thing to think about. See how much fun this course is? And so you get a huge museum building project, and you get an exhibition that France did it on a national scale in order to place itself and its intellectual cultural capacities in the forefront of the art world. The other thing that was happening in France with this exhibition is there was a commentary here about French colonialism, a deliberate commentary about French colonialism. The exhibition was curated by two people who still raise issues and raise controversy today. It was Jean-Hubert Martin, M-A-R-T-I-N, and a man named André Magnin, M-A-G-N-I-N. Is it in the study guide?
Oh, yes.
Okay, good. I should open my study guide. It would help. And Magnin amassed a lot of the work that is in the exhibition. Let me briefly, what page am I on, please?
Six.
Thank you. Briefly about the exhibition. There were 100 artists or artist cooperatives in the exhibition. It was located in two different buildings. One building you see going up here, and that's a building called the nickname is Centre Pompidou. The real name is the Centre Georges Pompidou. And it's in a district of Paris named Beaubourg, and if you go to Paris, you can see it all the time. It was a massive building effort, a very interesting building that is always quoted. And the slide that's on the screen is from 1977. And here's the piano building itself. and it was one of the first buildings. It's called the Inside Out Building, where the inside is dedicated to its exhibitions, and all of the systems of the building, air conditioning, heating, water, et cetera, are on the outside. Now, you know, we're already at 2007, but what you have to do is realize that this building was a hallmark in that kind of construction, which is now de rigueur. You're going to see a lot of buildings like this. But this was one of the first ones. And this is the escalator also on the outside of the building. I'm getting my little pointer out, that you can see that covered sort of caterpillar-like section is the escalator going up and down right here. So this is the building, and it was built specifically at, it opened with Musicien de la Terre. And then there's another building, a huge hangar-like building on the outskirts of Paris that all of the installations that I'm going to be showing you were in this other building. So there was a lot of publicity about this. This is it was the anniversary of the French Revolution, and so it fit in with a certain kind of political philosophy that was going on in France at the time. This is the issue of Art in America magazine that you can look at. Some of the slides, many of them, are from this issue of Art in America. And remember that I call the 80s the decade of multiculturalism. So this is at the end of the 80s that you're seeing this exhibition. And it opens up the 90s, and the 1990s in the art world are known as the age of globalism. So here we see an exhibition that is going to try to straddle multiculturalism to globalism. So they call it the global issue here. Okay. When I showed you Gauguin in the Primitivism show, I said you'll be seeing a different Gauguin later on, and that's what you're seeing now. This is the famous painter Gauguin living in the Marquesas. One of the things, and those of you who are serious art historians, go to the library. I put the Musicien de la Terre catalog, it's a large, thick book, on reserve. Just take it out. It's all in French. That's not the point. I want you to look at the introduction, the pictures. I'm showing you pictures now from the introduction, not to the exhibition, but to the catalog itself. Because one of the things that the curators said they were doing in this exhibition, they wanted to deconstruct the mythologies that primitivism proposed. And one of the ways that they felt that they were deconstructing those mythologies of primitivism is by publishing this kind of photograph. For those of you who've taken 20th century art, you might know that Gauguin deserted his family in Brittany. His wife and children starved while he lived it up with his many mistresses in the Marquesas and in Tahiti. So, I mean, that's sort of like the side story, but it's those side stories about quote-unquote heroes that primitivism did, and now Musicien is trying to sort of obstruct them, trying to deconstruct them in a Derrida kind of sense of the word. So this is one of the photographs that was in the introduction to the catalog. This is another photograph that was in the introduction to the catalog. Who knows who you're looking at? It's generational, I'm sure. Yeah, that's what I was afraid of. Not one person, huh? Do you have a film major in the class? Former film major? You don't know who this woman is? No?
The German film major.
Yeah, right.
Hand of the Will.
Very good. You get a star. Her name is Leni Riefenstahl. And she was Hitler's documentary filmmaker. She survived the regime. and she went on to become infamous famous, and there's still huge debates about her. And she went on and did some books about Africa. And the one of her most successful book is what this shot is taken from, and it's called The Last of the Nuba, N-U-B-A. The Nuba are a people from East Africa. They're very famous because they're tall and statuesque, and they have fabulous dances that now have become tourist attractions. But look for a moment at these two photographs that I just showed you. The first one is Gauguin, and the next one is Leni Riefenstahl. So what Ms. Sheehan is trying to do here is make a statement without having to write it down. This is sort of deconstructing. It's the whole deconstructionism of that became so important in the 1990s. But it's sort of deconstructing a certain kind of hero, heroine syndrome of Western culture. And then they're using sort of icons of Western culture in order to do that. Like, you're a little young, but this show opened in 1989, and I would say that 75 to 80% of the people would have recognized Leni Riefenstahl immediately. Okay? This is Josephine Baker. And you will get an entire lecture on Josephine Baker from me in the course of my lectures to you. But she again was put in this introductory section of the catalog. She was an African American from East St. Louis who ended up literally tearing the city of Paris apart. She became the most successful dancer at the Folies Bergère. She started her own perfume company. She started her own clothing company. She made movies. We'll see one of those movies later on in the course. She rose to a stature in Paris as an African-American performer that was the top of the line. And one of the things about her also that's so important is that at the Folies Bergère, it was totally legal to dance with your bare top and just a little pasty on your genital area. And it was not that long ago that the Showgirls of Las Vegas won their legal battle of not having to dance topless. I don't know if you're aware of that, but there was a big legal battle with their union. So Josephine Baker was the African-American performer who was put on a pedestal by French society. And we'll talk about that in this class, but they used her in this introductory section. So they had Gauguin, they had Leni Riefenstahl, and now they're having Josephine Baker. And then we have the exhibit itself. Now, the exhibit itself is set up this way. There are 100 artists or artist cooperatives. They are put together in the exhibition with absolutely no didactic commentary. Okay? There's no didactic commentary. If you look through the catalog, you'll see each artist gets one page. All that is there is the name of the artist, the country of origin, the title and date of the piece. The introduction to the exhibition states that all 100 artists in this exhibition are magicians of the earth. That we are looking at artistic production in its magical sense. We have chosen these 100 artists to put in the exhibition, and we're calling them all magicians. The obvious fault that everybody immediately recognized in this exhibition is that there were artists from around the world put together in one space without any didactics, and simply or merely by putting them together in this space, the museum said they were equal. But in fact, over 50%, maybe close to 70% of the artists in the exhibition were part of a Euro-American art world and had gallery representation and were very famous in mainstream art. They had gone to art school, most of them, not all of them, but they were part of a Euro-American art establishment. The 25% or 30% of the other artists were from countries in which there was either no art system or no gallery system, or the art and gallery system was bypassed deliberately by the curators. So what they did is they sent curatorial teams out, mostly to countries that were their former colonial possessions, but not always. There are other countries, as you'll see. And the curatorial teams chose artists or art cooperatives to put in the exhibition. When the question was raised about, well, why didn't you go to the Ministry of Culture? Or why didn't you go to a gallery or a major museum in Papua New Guinea, for example? They said, those artists are tainted by the West. And literally, that is what they said. Those artists are tainted by the West, and we want to include artistic production in this exhibition that is not tainted by the West. Therefore, we'll do our own research. We will not go through art channels, but only in certain countries and certain places in the world. And so right away, you should be thinking, well, this is not such a big step away from primitivism, is it? From primitivism as in the exhibition. So what I want to show you here are a series of slides. I want you to become familiar with the kind of art that was put, most of it was installation. Here's the big, this is the big hangar where the installations were put up outside, right in the suburbs. It's the last, La Villette is the last metro line going out to the suburbs in one direction. So we're looking at here, and then I have a film also. We're looking at here, it's called The House with a Mandala of Divinity, and monks from the country of Nepal were brought to Paris to put together this mandala. Here you have, and you can see it much better when I show you the film, but what you're doing is you're walking into this space, and on the ground is this drawing. It's a ground painting. And it's done by a cooperative community of Australian Aborigines. And I have spelled their name here, Yundumu, in your study guide. So it's the Yundumu Collective from Central Australia, made up of only Aboriginal Australian artists. For those of you who don't know, they are officially called Aborigines, and you spell that always with a capital A. Okay? So it's the Yundumu community from Central Australia. And then a very famous British artist in a cherry picker. Do you all know what that is? That machine that you can ride up and down in? And he did this absolutely gigantic yellow sphere on the wall. People I know who went to this exhibition said it was so strange. You walked into La Villette, and all this ethnic art, that's the word they used, was on the floor, and overlooking it on the wall, six times as big, was this big, bold yellow sphere done by a Brit. Okay? So this is Richard Long and the Yundumu community. And here we have what Richard Long became famous doing. This is a piece, it's called movable sculpture, right? You just move it anywhere and look through it and you've got a work of art. And this just dates to 1967. But that just to give you an idea who Richard Long is in the art world, okay? This connects, I guess so. The next artist is from Cuba, and his name is Jose Beria, and this is a very interesting story. I happen to have just been asked to do a 30-year retrospective of his work, and I happen to have been working with him since the 90s, so I know too much. I tend to talk too much when Jose gets up on the screen. They went to Cuba, the curators went to Cuba. By 1989, Cuba had already had its breakthrough in the art world with some of the most interesting third world themed international expositions during the 1980s. And by 1989, Cuba was the hottest art ticket around. So they went to Cuba and they asked the, you can't avoid governmental authority in Cuba, who was a religious artist, a good religious artist. And they all said Jose Betty, and he won the big prize at the Biennale. And when they went to visit Jose, Jose is a Hispanic Cuban who has been initiated and is a priest in an Afro-Cuban religion, and they absolutely refused to believe. The curators literally refused to believe that he was a religious initiate and was a priest, because they had this prejudice that they had to, you had to be black and semi-illiterate if you wanted to do that. So Jose had to introduce him to his community, to the man who initiated him, etc., etc. And then they asked, they said, we won't put you in this show unless we're allowed to see your altar. Yeah, this is a very true story. And so Jose sort of shrugged his shoulders, walked over to a little closet, opened the door of the closet. There was his altar. He said, here's my altar. Now you've seen it. Close the door and walk away. So anyway, he was included in the show. This is his installation. Jose has an MFA degree from the art school in Havana. So here is an artist who's a white Cuban with an MFA degree, who's initiated into an Afro-Cuban religion, and who's made it in the art world. All of his art reflects upon his religion. It is not religious art, but it is a reflection of his religion. The name of this piece is Living on the Tracks. And he built, okay, he built these pieces with bricks. This is in the museum in Paris. And he laid a piece of track across the top of the bricks. And then on the wall, he painted these figures. And what these are the end of the clavos, the end of the large nails. They're not nails, but I can't think of the English word.
Spikes,
right. That, you know, that are used to hold down the railway track. And then his spiritual figure, you don't have to memorize this part, is Sarabanda. So Sarabanda is the is a spirit that has control over iron. He's a spirit that watches over railway workers, etc., etc. So he's combining those forces. And then this dirt on the floor here is the island of Cuba. And then in one of the little compartments, in most religious artists, as you saw with the Maori show, refuse to open up their artwork to the public without proper blessings, protection, right, for everything that's happening. So Jose had wanted to do that with his artwork. So in this compartment, he has an altar. These are chicken feathers. This is a very interesting story. He asked for chickens to be brought in, and then three other of the artists, who you'll see, also needed chickens to do their blessings, and the curators looked at them like they were crazy, because they'd never held a live chicken in their lives. I probably just would have said, okay, I'll get you one, and then hired somebody. But they actually did. What happened was the custodial staff, who was all third world, saw no problem with bringing in chickens, because that's how they lived in their homeland. And the curators, really, it was a fight to let these artwork be blessed in the exhibition space. But this is I call it consecrated, that's the appropriate word. So here you have an artwork of the stature of the Euro-American gallery system, right, done by an MFA person who is also a priest. It's exactly what Magician wanted, and yet when they got it, they couldn't deal with all of the surrounding issues. So Jose Bedia really sort of pinpoints some of these issues well, because he was able to converse of both sides, right, on both sides of the problematic. So this is called Living on the Tracks, and it's dedicated to the iron workers and the railway workers of Cuba. Then we have Alfredo Yar, who is from Peru, I believe. And he is, you can still see his work online. He's a very famous gallery artist, again, with a degree in art making. And Yar made his reputation with these large color, saturated color photographs. But it's always interesting what he chooses to photograph. This is photographed in a dump in Nigeria. And it's a toxic dump. And this is how these young boys get products that they can now sell or bring home to their parents. That's how people make a living. Young boys scounging in a toxic dump. So this is the photograph that Yar put in Magician. So it's sort of contradicting that whole notion of magicians of the earth, right? It's sort of contradicting that and sort of exposing it by this kind of photograph or by what Bedia did. There's more coming up.
I'm sorry, what's his name? The last one?
J-A-A-R. Here is another piece he did, and it's 1989, in other words, done for the show, and it's called, the title of this piece is Geography Above All Serves to Make War. Geography Above All Serves to Make War, and look at the continent where war is being made. I hope you all recognize that continent, okay? So again, what you're seeing now is how artists are sort of causing this exhibition to be looked at in a way that was not intended. By the inclusion of certain kinds of artwork, they're causing the viewers to rethink the premise of all artists are magicians and all artists are equal as magicians. This is now the Australian community that was put in the exhibition, the Yindumu community. And I'm taking you now to their homeland in central Australia. This is where they live. Australia had a gathering in national policy that was very similar to the United States policy at the turn of last century called the reservation period policy, and all Aboriginal peoples, the owners of the soil and of the land of Australia, were gathered in and forced to live on the equivalent of reservations. And they were not given the right to vote until the 1980s. I should know the date by heart, and I'm sorry, I don't. Okay? So Australian Aboriginal culture is a very well-known culture, and its treatment by national authorities is very controversial. And they were chosen to be put in this exhibition. So this is the kind of quote-unquote reservation that they live in Australia. They, their society is broken up into male and female lineages. It's based on a principle of ownership of the land, which is very ironic considering the Australian national government does not let them own any land anymore. And the way the heritage of the land is expressed is through ground drawings that are done collaboratively, communally. And these ground drawings are entitled dreamings. It's the official name of these drawings. They're called a dreaming with a capital D. And the story that the dreaming tells is the story of each clan's ownership of certain areas of earth. And that they are passed down visually and orally. So what you're looking at now is a group of men who are constructing a dreaming artistically in order to write a textbook, in other words, about the ownership of their part of the land. And so what happened was that these became very famous. And in order, these people are incredibly poor, and in the 1970s, some sort of Peace Corps types from Australia, they were teachers, here's one of them right here, asked if the artists, the Aboriginal artists, would like to transfer their designs to Canvas so that he could help distribute them and sell them. And so with the permission of the elder community, in the late 1970s, these ground drawings were then, you can see it here, transferred to Canvas. They now are sold worldwide. If your cooperative was a good one, you don't get your land back in Australia, but you have made a profit so that you could have a four-wheel drive car, you could have extra food, you could have your refrigerator, you could have your television. Right? Does this sound vaguely familiar in terms of Native American communities? There's a real parallel here. So they did make, and so they the curators went to Australia, to the Yundumu community. Here's a female lodge's ground drawing, dreaming, expressing the same kind of heritage. And you will see in the film the fact that this community constructed, and you saw it on the floor below the Richard Long, they constructed one of their dreamings on the floor at Sontra, at Mijishian. And this is the photograph that was put in Art in America. And again, that whole idea of the exotic and the spectacle. I mean, in other words, rather than choosing other color photographs, this is the one that you can see the page that Art in America chose as the largest photograph on their spread. And here's a completed dreaming in a very famous book about the dreamings, and deconstructed just enough for the appetite of the consumer of the book, but not telling everything. So this became Australian Aboriginal art has become a very important art form in the 21st century.
The parallel is interesting between this and certain Native American like sand drawings.
You're going to see it in the film.
Oh, okay.
Good for you, and it's in the film. The Yundumu, the Australian Aboriginals come to the United States a lot and vice versa. There's some very important political organizations about ownership of the land that Native American councils and Australian Aboriginal councils have collaborated on. So it reaches beyond the art world even. The next group of people that were put in the show come from South Africa. They're called Ndebele. And all I have is South Africa. Estra Malangu, I wrote down South Africa. These are the Ndebele peoples from South Africa. And again, the curators deliberately chose them. What they're famous for is the females of the lineage paint the exterior of their compounds. And that's what you're looking at here. These are the paintings themselves are dedicated to the males who become initiated into adulthood, but it's always painted by their female relatives. Okay? So this is the Ndebele community in South Africa. And this is a classic house, and it's the front of the house. I don't know if some of you might have seen this type of design before. This is sort of classic Ndebele painting. And this is Esther Malango, who was actually brought to Paris. You'll see her in the film. And she painted a house that was built for this in the exhibition. But everything has something else associated with it in the spectacle culture that we're all a part of. And this is a 1990. The same thing happens with the Ndebeles, that in order to get monetary benefit from their artwork, somebody decides to ask them to transfer their motifs on paper or canvas, and then that is sold commercially. Now, it really depends on who that somebody is, how much money the artist him or herself is going to receive. Okay, but Esther Malangu has become pretty well known around the world because she goes around and does art that is then sold within a gallery system. But she was not heard of in the gallery system until Musicien de la Terre. And what I wanted to show you is what happens in our spectacle-dominated world today. I'm going to show you two, I feel, very disturbing photographs from Sports Illustrated bathing suit issue of 1996. Okay? This is Kathy Ireland wearing a Norma Kamali designed bathing suit. First time I saw this, I kind of just couldn't keep, you know, my mouth just sort of fell open. One of my former students is now a professor at the University of North Carolina, is writing a book, and I saw her recently, and she said, I remember you taught Kathy Ireland, but have you ever taught Georgina Roberts in that course? I said, no. She said, I'll email you that one, because I never went out and spent money on the Sports Illustrated, because I didn't want to give them my money. This is Georgina Robertson, excuse me, in the same issue of Sports Illustrated. And what happened when, so this student of mine whose book has been accepted for publication took these photographs and the magazine back to Indivele and met the artists who are in all these spreads. And they were really shocked at this one. They just, you know, the Kathy Ireland, they said, oh, we would never dress like that, but they could not understand how somebody could use their motifs and pose like this without any clothes on. It was really, it gave them great pause. So this is sort of the consequence of the kind of, the consequence of Maori publicity, the consequence of Australian Aboriginal publicity that we have to, it's part of the art world. It's part of something that people in the art world have to be concerned about. The priest from the country of Benin in West Africa, his name is Cyprian Tokudaba, it is written down so you can spell it. And Benin is next to Nigeria in West Africa. He's a priest of the Vodou religion, and he was brought to the Centre Pompidou. So this is his installation, and it's based on a group of sculpture that was in his temple in Benin, and then he reconstructed it for the exhibition. And the same thing kind of happened with him that happened with these other artists. This is the kinds of abstracted sacred motifs that are on the doors of the temples of his religion in Benin. And then what happens is he became a sought-after artist. And so the images themselves were displaced from their religious context. He reproduces them on canvas or on paper, and he sells them commercially. So there's, you know, this is the most important, I think, consequence of the installations that were done at Magicien, that these artists then are entering a commercial art world. So this is Tokudaba's drawings that are sold commercially. It's completely as just as art, with no, you know, didactic or religious context. And I think this is one of the two final artists do sculpture. And this is another, I think, challenging little commentary. Remember I told you that the curators who went to all these countries to choose that 25% of the artists who were not part of the Euro-American or the gallery system art world said that they were going themselves to find artists who were not tainted by the West. Well, one of the interesting things is you get a sculptor, and this is a sculptor who works in painted cement. He's from Nigeria. His name is Sunday Jack Akpan. I hope it's there.
It is.
Good. And these are painted cement sculptures that are used as funerary monuments. If Christianity had not come in to West Africa, they wouldn't have funerary monuments for bodies that are buried. Because in indigenous Africa, you cremate your bodies, and you don't use up good soil to put bodies in the ground and make funerary monuments. You might have a funeral, but it's out of material that will then go back to the earth. It's perishable material. It's temporary. So here you have just this notion that these curators just didn't get it. Right? They just didn't get it. I don't know if they didn't want to get it. So you have an artist who does fabulous funerary sculpture, but it's predicated on Christianity having entered this region in the 1800s. So this is his painted cement. You can see, here it is. This is the graveyard. And I've seen him twice already at different museums that are doing African art shows. Akpan is brought in to make these sculptures and paint them, and the public comes and talks to him, and it's part of sort of an outreach program. So he also has now entered the gallery art world. Yes?
What are these made out of?
Cement.
Oh.
Painted cement. Okay, so that's sort of this exhibition. I'm not showing you the 80% of the artists who are the Euro, what I call the Euro-American artists, because that's like any other show you would go to see. So what happened was that this show was proved to be as controversial as the Primitivism show. Just Google it and you won't believe it, or you will believe it. Because it's making a different kind of mistake than primitivism, but it's equating, it's again this universalizing aesthetic that I was talking about with you last week. This whole notion that these artists have the ability to be seen as equals because the museum says they are. Most of the criticism written about this show, very articulate criticism, by 1989, said, wait a minute, why do they have to be equals? A Yundumo artist from a collective in Central Australia does not have to be equal to Richard Long. They can do things differently for different reasons, and we can teach the public that both of them are viable. So again, you get this idea of the translation of this art into a one-way system without an appreciation for the fact that difference is probably, the appreciation of difference, I'll say, is probably more important than a universalizing similarity aesthetic. Because when you equate these artists and call them all magicians, you're not teaching people that art can be different and still be great, that it can be done for different reasons and look differently and not participate in systems of commerce and still be regarded as worthwhile. And isn't that what multiculturalism in the 1980s was all about? So this is why this is such an important exhibition coming right at the end of the decade of the 1980s. Yes?
How would you have preferred that it was done different? Would you have preferred that they
say, it's really impossible to ask what if questions.
But
it's much better to understand what happened than to say what if they had done it differently.
Well, what is the correct way to do it?
I don't know that I would think that correct is a word I would ever use.
Because, I mean, I wouldn't think that just because they're saying they're all magicians, I wouldn't think that they're saying that they're all equal.
Well, they are, because they remember, 100 artists, everybody gets the same didactic. Your name, the name of the piece, the date, and the country where you're from. The museum said, we are treating everybody the same.
So maybe they should have had a story that describes the artwork.
Again, I don't teach what if, because I think that's dangerous. Because what I teach is for you to understand what happened. I'm a historian. right? So what I'm teaching is to understand what came historically, not what if we did it. You know, the what if is what you will do in your careers later on. What I'm bringing up are the issues that I want you to think about and take home. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Other comments? So what time, the class is over at 10 of 6, 7, right? Okay. Oh, it's over in 5 minutes? Okay, I can't show you the video now. So, okay, so let me see what I had next. Africa explores. We all really only have 5 minutes left?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's no way. What I'll do is on Thursday then, we'll do the last three exhibitions, and we've also got a video. Yes? I can't hear you. No, that's not this Thursday. It's next Thursday. Yeah, there's no class because it's Rosh Hashanah, and I take a religious holiday. But not this Thursday. I need to see those few people to add, and if you can come up.
We don't take very many notes.